This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechemir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, a question of ethics, from farmland to disclosure forms. We'll check in on Senator Ted Stevens' trial in Washington, D.C., plus how people and bears share space.
We're going to have brown bears, they're going to be exploring Anchorage. And if they explore Anchorage and, hey, look at that, I got salmon in the stream, they're going to park their butts right here and stick around.
That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Scott Burton. It would be hard not to know that Senator Ted Stevens' corruption trial is underway in Washington, D.C. Stevens faces 7 felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms. Jury selection and opening statements are complete. New witnesses are being called each day. Prosecutors allege that Stevens knowingly hid $250,000 worth of extravagant gifts, mostly from oilfield services company Vico, including a Land Rover, a gas grill, and home renovations, while at the same time working on legislation that benefited the company. His lawyers say he's an honest public servant whose mistake was trusting a devious person, former Vico CEO Bill Allen. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the trial. In fact, the whole Stevens case has been a little bit of a trial by fire for her. She started her new gig as APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent one day before Stevens was indicted. AK's Jessica Cochran reached Libby as she stood outside the courthouse.
So, Libby, you started your job in D.C. on July 28th, and I understand that you had an interview with Senator Stevens on your first day. What did you guys talk about?
Well, I'd set it up before coming to D.C. because I wanted to talk to him before his primary election bid. And we talked about what was happening in Congress, and he was fiery and emphatic and even shouted a little bit about energy legislation and ANWR and things like that. But we also talked about ethics, because Senator Stevens' home was raided by the FBI last summer. And even though he's not willing to talk about that specifically, I did want to ask him just about his moral beliefs, where he stands on things, what his ethical principles are.
So what did he say?
Well, even though he'd been sort of ranting and shouting a few minutes earlier about Congress and votes, he got really quiet and reflective and said he believes in family and he believes in Alaska. And he feels like he's served Alaska for 40 years, in fact, longer than 40 years, and that Alaskans should be able to trust him and know who he is by now.
Okay, so then the next day he was indicted. How did you even find out that was happening?
Well, day two in my Washington, D.C. career here started, and it was like, okay, what's happening in Washington today? How do you even figure this stuff out? Well, in a couple of hours, I had my answer. I got a call from a producer at APRN who said, oh my gosh, you know, just over the wire news that Senator Stevens has been indicted. And so I hung up the phone and called another Alaskan reporter I knew here, and together we tried to figure out just what was going on. And we found out that there was going to be a press conference at the Department of Justice in 20 minutes, and we needed to be there to find out the details. So I couldn't even figure out how to get out of the building I was in. I was in a congressional building for an interview. So once I finally found the front door, I found a taxi and was able to get to the Department of Justice. And it was a different world. I mean, there was a line of reporters out the door, and it was kind of my, oh, we're not in Kansas anymore sort of moment, because there were reporters from NBC, CNN, the New York Times, who were all interested in our senator.
So what kind of a learning curve did you have to go through to figure out, you know, what was happening next in this whole process, whether it was a court proceeding or, you know, where? How did you figure out where to get your information from?
Well, I owe a lot to the guy who had this job for a long time before I did, Joel Southern, who taught me that a lot of it is on the internet these days. You know, you got to be on the right email list. You got to call the right people. You got to bug them every day. You know, I've been calling over to the courts here every day until I could really get on their radar and figure out what was going on. But a lot of this is online, and so I'm able to track when motions are filed in the case or when there's going to be a hearing between the lawyers. And now I'm at the courthouse every day, so you just sort of stay tuned and doggedly, I mean, it's sort of the unromantic side of being a reporter. You just doggedly do your research.
So now that that trial has started, can you just kind of describe the scene a little bit for us? I mean, what, you know, what is the courtroom like? How full is it? Where are you when you're doing your reporting?
Yeah, well, the courthouse is right in the heart of D.C., just a few blocks away from the Capitol. And when you go into the courtroom where this trial is taking place, you really feel the gravity of this situation. You know, the judge sits in front of the scales of justice, and you definitely feel the weight of this proceeding. I mean, there hasn't been a sitting senator on trial for nearly 30 years. And and the busiest day we've had was when opening statements were delivered, and the courtroom was packed with reporters from all over the country, major national outlets, as well as supporters of Ted Stevens, and a ton of lawyers, more lawyers than I've ever seen in my life. And since then, things have quieted down a little bit. You know, that was kind of the big drama. The reporters can either sit in the courtroom and listen. You know, we can't bring in our laptops or recorders or anything. Or we can sit in a media room. And that is a room where we can sort of work and also watch what's going on a video screen. We can hear the judge. We can see Senator Stevens and see the witnesses as they testify. And there's a lot of reporters in there. And there's a lot of Alaskan reporters, which is great. And there are also some from national outlets. And you definitely sort of form some bonds with those people.
Does it feel competitive with the other reporters, or is it more of a friendly atmosphere?
I don't feel competitive. I'm sure some of them do, but I think it's a good experience for us. I mean, sometimes you have to work together. You know, sometimes I might miss something or they might miss something. It all, what comes around goes around. So I think you try to treat each other well. And I like the sense of camaraderie. And we're in that this little room together, you know, for 8+ hours a day, working intensely, listening intensely, writing intensely. And, you know, Jessica, what it kind of reminds me of is covering a sled dog race, which probably sounds really weird, but it's that same level of just, you know, kind of around-the-clock intensity and total focus and feeling with the other reporters like you've been thrown into something intense together. Although, of course, I do get to go home and sleep in a nice, comfortable bed at night, and it's not 40 below. And there are a lot of people in suits around, so it's not quite Alaska.
Well, thank you so much, Libby, for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thanks a lot, Jessica.
Libby Casey will be at the courthouse covering Senator Stevens' trial daily. It's expected to last about a month. Senator Stevens isn't the only member of Alaska's congressional delegation tied up in corruption allegations. Congressman Don Young has been questioned by the Justice Department, some say about his ties with the oil field services company Vico. He's also been linked to jailed former lobbyist Jack Abramoff. At the state level, lobbyist and former director of the Alaska Democratic Party, Bill Bobrick, pled guilty last year to conspiracy for bribing. And former Governor Frank Murkowski's chief of staff, Jim Clark, pled guilty in 2006 to conspiracy. Despite the scandals, many say lobbyists do an honest day's work and are an integral part of our democratic process. Juneau lobbyist John Walsh spends his days working on behalf of school districts and municipalities, among others.
My take, for the most part, is that lobbying is the advancement of the needs of the public to their elected officials or to the executive branch, and hopefully getting that further along than it might otherwise on its own.
His 11 clients also include fishing companies and trade associations. He works pro bono for the Alaska Special Olympics. They need professionals like Walsh to make connections with new members of both the executive and legislative branch. to attend committee meetings, meet with staff, and advance their interests.
People in business or that have other pursuits just don't have the time to be here and running their businesses. So I suggest that our services as lobbyists help them to use their time most effectively and advance their issues as efficiently as they can.
Is it important for you to believe in one of your clients' interests for you to be able to effectively represent them?
I think so. In some cases, it's not as if you need to believe or not believe. It's just, it's simply an issue. So it doesn't have a personality to it, if you will. Or in other cases, it's hugely comforting to identify with your client. In my case, my client base is such that it's not difficult at all. In fact, I've developed a lot of real close relations with my clients.
He also creates relationships with lawmakers and their staffs. And for him, they have to be based on honesty. The biggest mistake he can imagine making would be to intentionally misrepresent information to a lawmaker, because that information is crucial to what lawmakers do.
These are constituent legislators. These folks come from all walks of life. There's a chiropractor, there's a boat builder, there's a fisherman, there's an attorney. So they come into the building representing their constituents, and they clearly do not know all issues. I don't know that anybody does. So they need information from staff, they need it from testimony, from the record, from the public, and they have to make decisions based on that.
And those decisions can affect a lot of Alaskans. So lobbyists like Walsh have to register with the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Many folks think about it as primarily enforcement or compliance, and that's certainly part of the job.
Patricia Ware is the administrator at the Juneau APOC office.
But part of what we are trying to also do is increase our outreach and education efforts with lobbyists and employers, so that there is a lot more information that we're providing proactively, so there will be less errors in reporting, less late reports, and less confusion about what the law requires on the part of lobbyists and employers.
The report's purpose is to show the public who is contributing to elected officials. If there are discrepancies in the reporting, it can be an indication of wrongdoing.
I think we do perform an important service to the community and the public, disclosing information so that they understand who is influencing legislation and administrative action, who's receiving monies for those services. So I feel good about the work that we do, and it's never boring and it's different every day.
In July 2007, Governor Palin signed Comprehensive Ethics House Bill 109 into law. It affects lobbyists, employers of lobbyists, legislators, and others covered by the Legislative Ethics Act and public officials. It requires APOC to administer annual ethics training and compliance courses to both lobbyists and their employers. APOC staff hope it will reduce honest reporting mistakes. In an office that many say is understaffed, that could free up time to look into bigger issues. After the break, is development edging out farmland in the Matanuska Valley?
I know farmers that get called every day and buy your property. Some farmers are close to or adjacent to gravel pits. Name your price. We'll pay it. We don't care.
Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. The Matanuska Valley's growth spurt during the past decade has come at a cost. Some residents are worried that the valley's farmland and its agricultural heritage are disappearing so quickly beneath development bulldozers that the valley lifestyle will be plowed under too. As AK's Ellen Lockyer reports, a new move to protect the valley's open acreage is gaining ground, and new strategies are being explored to save the old farms.
Between 2003 and 2007, close to 6,000 homes were built in the Matanuska Valley. The Matanuska Susitna Borough does not track building permits, but does tally property tax revenues. Borough data indicates a slowdown in growth the last couple of years, although a drive up the park's highway into Wasilla leads to a maze of shopping centers, car dealerships, and an urban sprawl that rivals anything on the East Coast. It's this welter of asphalt and concrete that is disturbing Steve Gallagher.
We can't make new land. Once it's paved over, it's, you know, I don't know, 100 years from now, maybe we'll be digging up houses and getting them out of the way so we can go back to planting food.
Gallagher heads the Alaska Farmland Trust, a recently formed nonprofit which works with federal programs to pay cash-strapped farmers in advance for the development rights to their farms. The move locks the land into agricultural production no matter who the farmer may sell it to in the future. The trust's first purchase near Wasilla highlights a growing concern, no pun intended, about the fate of Valley agriculture.
We couldn't hang on to it being retired.
Leroy Heaven was at risk of losing his farm and became the first farmer to sell his development rights to the trust. Years ago, he bought the farm so it would not be developed as a gravel pit. But later growth narrowed his choices, to be taxed off his land or to sell to developers.
I'm retired now, and we hired a farmer who loves to do it, to do our land, because if you have a big chunk of land, if you don't farm it and just let it sit there, you're going to pay a high tax on it. Otherwise, if it's being farmed, you pay a reduced rate.
Heaven found an alternative way to stay on his land and stay within his tax budget, but younger men who want to make a living in agriculture have a tough road to hoe, literally. Art Keys, for instance.
I plant about 5,000 corn plants a year, and the spacing on them is a 12 by 12, so 12 inches apart. Two rows in one bed.
Keyes has a working farm in Palmer. He's demonstrating a shiny new piece of equipment he bought using a rural development loan. The rotating transplanter cuts planting time, Keyes told a group visiting Palmer's University of Alaska-owned experimental farm. Keyes is trying to expand beyond the usual valley potato and cabbage crop to be able to sell a variety of fresh produce in Anchorage. It's a dreary, wet Wednesday afternoon out on the asphalt of the city's Diamond Center parking lot, 50 yards from a construction project.
They've had dump trucks running all week filling this back up, but they pulled out some of the most beautiful, blackest topsoil you've ever seen to put gravel on top of it. Yeah, they brought gravel from Matanuska to cover the topsoil in Anchorage. It was amazing.
The setting perfectly illustrates the farmer's plight. Keyes brings his fresh valley produce.
I grow mainly zucchini. And in the greenhouse is tomatoes and cucumbers and eggplant. And we've got about 4,000 strawberry plants growing.
And sells it at two Anchorage outdoor markets. Along with a wintertime job, he makes enough to support his family. He says borough tax breaks help. Just not much.
There is a tax break on your land, on your property tax for having a farm. But yeah, I don't know. It's not enough of an incentive to become a farmer.
So what is the highest, best use of the land? The land that is increasingly valuable to real estate developers. Does it make sense to develop all the productive agricultural land? The lure of a big cash sellout is tempting, especially to farmers who don't have heirs who want to farm. Leroy Heaven.
And there's 40-acre plots of farmland over on Springer Loop and Palmer that have sold for $1 million for housing development. I mean, I know one gentleman, and I don't blame him. He's the head of the family trust. And when somebody comes along and offers you $1 million for 40 acres, I think you'd get outvoted.
Steve Gallagher says some farmers are holding out against the cash.
I know farmers that get called every day. Some farmers are close to or adjacent to gravel pits. Name your price. We'll pay it. We don't care because we just want the gravel underneath. You know, it's such a tempting thing when they're struggling as they do.
But is the state or the borough doing enough to keep the land and the farmers in agriculture? Many would say no. Representative Bill Stoltz's District 16 is home to most of the small family farms in the valley. Stoltz says the new Valley Hospital, built on what was a cow pasture a couple of years ago, is pushing some bordering farms into a new tax bracket.
The Valley Regional Hospital going on Trunk Road certainly put a lot of pressure on farms adjacent to there.
The hospital towers over surrounding hayfields. As it is, old barns close to the hospital are being remodeled into coffee shops and gift stores. And last year, one abandoned barn down the road was actually trucked away to a museum in Wasilla. As if Matanuska farming has become a thing of the past, Stoltz says Valley farmland has become a pawn of economic change.
Competing economic interests erode the amount of farmland that's available over time.
Palmer Mayor John Combs says the city welcomes development, as long as that development fits a certain profile outlined by city planners. He says the city is working to preserve its cultural heritage, but...
I wish the city of Palmer had this giant bag of money that just fell in our lap so we could run around and match a 50% on everything that's across from the fairgrounds. It's got all these fields that have for sale signs on them.
Palmer has a 3% sales tax, but so far not much retail business to support it. Combs says new business and new residents are what will pave the way to the city's future.
Our focus really is on professional, technical, cultural type entities to take a look at Palmer providing services to bring in higher end professional people with discretionary income.
Attracting those kinds of companies will take first class housing. Combs says the city cannot regulate the farmers' right to sell their property to whom they choose. There are no easy answers. Meanwhile, development continues, and so do the headaches. A new school to serve subdivisions built near Wasilla has created a boondoggle for the borough because an access road to the school may cost over $8 million. Borough taxpayers will have to foot the bill. And just this month, the borough passed an ordinance prohibiting gravel mining below the water table in an effort to protect farm fields from flooding. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
I hate to see the farmer is the last of a dying breed. Living off the land and taking what he needs.
So, when is it okay to kill a bear? This summer, a series of serious brown bear maulings within Anchorage and on the Kenai Peninsula may have more people than usual pondering that question. In Kenai and Anchorage, the number of bears shot by people is way up this year. AK's Jessica Cochran has more.
By law, you can kill a bear outside of a normal hunting season if it is in defense of life or property. State biologists call them DLPs, and the number of DLPs is high this year. On the Kenai, at least 34 brown bears have died from human-caused mortality, which also includes vehicle collisions, poached animals, or bears authorities ended up killing. In Anchorage, 19 black bears and 2 browns have been shot. At least that's how many have been reported. There are rumors of many more. The number of bear-human encounters this year prompted the Anchorage Assembly's Public Safety Committee to call an unprecedented evening meeting Thursday night. The goal was to come up with possible solutions. More than a dozen people offered possibilities. Those urging coexistence with bears backed more public education, future trail and construction development that acknowledged Anchorage's wildlife, both moose and bears, and more municipal involvement, such as hiring a city wildlife specialist. Others maintained there are simply too many bears roaming about Anchorage parks and neighborhoods. Several said there may have been a comfortable relationship with bears when the city's population was between 80 and 100,000, but it's vanished now as Anchorage approaches the 300,000 mark. Assemblymember Bill Starr of Eagle River agreed with the latter. He says the city and the expectations of its residents have changed.
We've urbanized. We need safe neighborhoods, and we don't have them. We may have to clash in that debate as we get to a new solution. But I'm not going to let it go that we need to keep our trash in our garages, and we need to be that. I think our citizen population looks to see a certain relevance to having safe trails. We built them. We should have them safe. We should be able to enjoy the botanical garden in fall. What I mean by that is we need to have effective and practical solutions, some of which may be to proactively kill bears. Because I think our urban countryside is the landscape that we've created for that. We have a rural countryside, and the laws of nature apply there.
Fish and game researcher Sean Farley says killing bears in the city is difficult. It's hard to hunt bears without baiting them, and that wouldn't be such a wise plan in a populated area.
You can't have a big game hunt, brown bear or even moose, in a truly urban setting. I mean, the last thing that anybody wants is to have a gut shot brown bear rampaging through your subdivisions. The fact is, when you have a hunt, there are some animals that sometimes are wounded.
But he also doesn't think it would work in the long run. More would come in from Chugach State Park, even by swimming across Kinnick Arm. They stay because we as communities keep providing food for them.
And that food may come in the form of garbage that's placed inappropriately and you get black bears that hit it. And it may come in the form of moose calves or adult moose that the bears, blacks and browns, are killing. And it may come in the form of the salmon and the streams that the bears are getting also.
And he says we're looking for trouble if we keep encroaching in areas where the bears want to be.
If we have food issues that are natural food like fish in streams and we're putting trails right next to those streams, then those bears will use it. I mean, we should document it very clearly with our GPS collars that the brown bears use the same damn trails that we use. And so if we put a trail right along a salmon stream, then you better be not surprised if you turn the corner when you're doing a jog and find a brown bear is looking at you. And it could be a mom with cubs and she won't take kindly to being disturbed. Because you put the trail there, you put the fish there, that's what she's going to use. And you're going to be right in her little territory.
Farley thinks in Anchorage we should be working to reduce the bears' food sources. Reducing moose numbers in town is hard. Fish and Game is working to increase moose hunts around the edges of town. But Farley looks more to reducing the number of fish in area streams by not enhancing their habitat and augmenting their numbers. The idea isn't popular. Bill Sherwanet is a bear lover and nature writer who writes about bear encounters in his new book, Living with Wildness. He thinks the burden lies with humans. Evidence indicates bear numbers haven't gone up significantly, and he says this summer's serious attacks were provoked by people.
You know, we humans are supposed to be the more intelligent species, and sometimes you just have to wonder. You know, the first mauling occurred because people were doing the worst possible thing. They were moving at fast speed on bicycles along a trail with very poor visibility, and they were doing this at night along a stream that biologists knew grizzly bears were concentrating along. And this had been in the news. It's not like this was new information for people after the fact.
Sherwanet says people who live near wildlife ought to educate themselves. By learning about bear behavior, they can minimize their chances of a dangerous encounter. To him, it's just common sense.
But if people choose to be ignorant or choose to ignore the advice, if they don't pay attention, if they choose to be either lazy, or, you know, there's this attitude that some people have, no one is going to tell us how to live our lives. There's always going to be people with that attitude, so there always is going to be some problems, some issues when humans and bears are sharing the landscape.
In Sean Farley's perfect world, any number of bears and humans could share the landscape and avoid serious maulings. But he doesn't believe that perfect world is likely. This year, 8 miles of new mountain biking trails were built in the same park where the maulings occurred.
We can't prevent people from going out and using the park. I mean, the park's for people to be able to get out there. And so there's got to be some sort of intermediate ground where people recognize that they have to make some concessions to wildlife unless they're willing to completely tolerate getting the occasional mauling and death from brown bears, which frankly I don't think people will tolerate. You know, they shouldn't.
And so what we're left with is
a big paradox that we have to resolve.
Failure to solve that paradox can only mean continued conflict between bears and humans, resulting in more bears being shot and killed. For AK, I'm Jessica Cochran.
Now we head out around the state. On this week's segment of 300 Villages, we visit Aleknagik in southwest Alaska and Glacier View along the Glen Highway.
This is Bernie Andrews. I live in Aleknagik. I work as a community health practitioner, and I'm also the current mayor of Aleknagik. We're located in southwest Alaska, Bristol Bay region. Our nearest city is Dillingham. We are mostly a commercial fishing and also a subsistence community. We have about 241 residents in Aleknagik. We have a lot of high school students going to Mount Edgecombe High School. Aleknagik is top of Wood River, so we get a lot of salmon here that go through, that go up to the Wood-Tikchik State Parks. So we get a lot of salmon. We go moose hunting, and caribou we'd have to go far away for. We do a lot of berry picking, and it's a nice, tight-knit community. From the stories I've heard, Aleknagik means the wrong way home. People going back up the Nishigap River would take the wrong turn and go up the Wood River and find out they are in Aleknagik instead of Nishigap. Aleknagik is a small community more separated by a lake and the Wood River. And our Wood River Project, Aleknagik Wood River Project, would until a bridge over the Wood River and connect North Shore to South Shore.
My name is Rex Close. I live in Glacier View, which is about the mile 100 on the Glen Highway, and I am retired. Glacier View is located right at the Matanuska Glacier, mile post 102 on the Glen Highway. The population presently in Glacier View in the comprehensive plan area is about 175 people. As far as employment in Glacier View, there is very little. There are some local roadhouses and lodges that employ locals and some seasonal people from outside. There are a lot of slope workers that live here, and more there are some retired people that are moving into the area. Recreation in the Glacier View area in the summertime is hiking, berry picking, just sightseeing. In the wintertime, of course, there's snow machines, dog sled racing. We have a couple dog sled teams that are in this area, and cross-country skiing. And I've got quite a, the locals call it a mini museum here. I collect primitive woodworking tools. I've got a whole wall full of those. I collect John Deere tractors, the two-cylinder, they call them Johnny Poppers. A couple of them go back 50 to 60 years. I have one modern-day tractor here, and I have a total of eight or nine. Not all green, but almost all of them are antiques. It's just me privately, but I certainly have no problem showing it to people, and it's amazing the word of mouth. A number of people that will come by and say, hey, I hear you've got some John Deere's. And if anybody shows up, I give them the tour. And I've never had one go away mad.
We heard from Berna Andrews in Aleknagik and Rex Close in Glacier View. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. After the break, how Alaska scandals may be used as an international example. Plus, just what is ethics anyway?
We all know it has something to do with right and wrong. But where I take them mostly in my classes is that it's a public choice. It's a collective choice. It's more about what we agree on together in terms of the rules that we'll follow. And we start to see that it is about collective agreement more than absolutes.
We'll mull things over with a professor. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Scott Burton, and this week, we're talking about ethics. Alaska may be well known for its widespread ethical and corruption problems these days, but our state is not alone. Political scandals are common across the country and around the world, and according to at least one expert, the recipe for mischief includes some common ingredients on every continent. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
A good political corruption scandal may simmer for years or even decades before boiling over. But as it's cooking, one of the most common ingredients in the mix is a sticky sludge familiar to all Alaskans.
Many experts will tell you that the energy sector, oil sector, is probably a breeding ground of corruption.
Dr. Marcin Walecki is a political corruption expert with the International Foundation for Electoral Systems in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit democracy development organization. Walecki has worked in Liberia, Kenya, Afghanistan, and more than a dozen other countries. And he says across the globe, most oil companies aren't very transparent when it comes to sharing money with politicians and political parties.
We've seen it over the last 20 years in number of cases that oil companies have been involved in a very serious high-profile corruption scandals. So, you know, people are joking that all these politicians who are dealing with oil companies are suffering from a political version of AIDS, which is additional income deposited in Switzerland.
But natural resource wealth isn't the only prerequisite for a good scandal. Walecki says another common denominator is a lack of turnover in political office.
If you don't see change happening regularly and you have one political group staying in power for too long, this links become corrupt.
Valetsky says over the years and decades, longtime politicians tend to develop very close ties to oil executives. He says the third and final trigger that can lead to corruption is the absence of strong, independent media organizations.
I think every country should go through what you had in the U.S., Watergate scandal, just to create this level of professional investigative journalism, so journalists know that they can do this kind of work.
Even in the most transparent and open societies, Valetsky says scandals will happen. But he says in all cases, including Alaska's, the corruption itself isn't as important as how enforcement agencies and institutions respond.
Are we going to see major reforms happening? Are we going to see movement into a new period of modernization and reform? Are certain corrupt elites going to be removed, replaced by more transparent and accountable individuals? So all those questions are crucial for any country, for any state. How will Alaska respond to this political scandal?
Valetsky has been paying attention to Alaska's recent scandals, partly because he wants to use the investigation into Senator Ted Stevens as an example for developing democracies around the world. Stevens is on trial for failing to account for more than $250,000 worth of gifts on his financial disclosure forms. Valetsky says it's a good lesson in the importance of a simple anti-corruption tool like financial disclosure.
I think that people around the world are going to look at this case, are going to see that even the most senior politicians cannot escape accountability.
Corruption scandals involving oil companies have popped up in recent years in France, Germany, Poland, Angola, Sudan, and Russia. But Valetsky says he doesn't get depressed by the news. Instead, he sees a trend in the right direction.
I generally believe that we see a greater level of transparency. It's not perfect. There's another few decades of reforms ahead of all of us. But, you know, when I read about political scandals which were taking place in the 70s and 80s, I think we made a major progress. And we have much better tools to control our political elites than we had 20, 30 years ago.
And even though Alaska's case fits so well into at least two of the three most important preconditions for corruption, Valetsky says there's hope we won't have to weather another big scandal. He says states with great natural resource wealth just need to put a lot of emphasis on transparency and accountability and keep a close eye on their businessmen and politicians. For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
Transparency and accountability. There are those words again. But does that really address the ethical issue? I mean, doesn't it seem like anyone who gives a candidate money would expect to have a little extra influence over that candidate? I put the question to Dr. Jonathan Anderson, a professor of public administration who teaches ethics at the University of Alaska Southeast.
The fact is that contributions to a campaign inevitably create a connection between the candidate and the donor. They have a relationship now, and that relationship allows communication. You know, they usually say access. It, the bigger the contribution, inevitably allows more access. So they can talk to him more. They can present their opinions. The candidate, of course, says to themselves, I am not agreeing or disagreeing with this person. I'm just listening to them. I can reject anything they say. I'm just listening to them. But the very fact that they listen to some people and not others has its impact. Now, they can't talk to everybody, but they make choices over who they talk to, and that has its influence.
And, you know, right there is where some people say that money has more access to government. Is that true?
Oh, there's no question. In the Supreme Court and the Buckley decision back in the early 90s, I think it was, made the decision that money is free speech. And that was there when they put their limits on how far government could go in limiting campaign contributions. They said to some extent you can, but you can't suppress it entirely because the right of people to spend their money to get a radio broadcast out, print, anything is part of free speech. And that gives money the influence that is different from one person, one vote, because money is not distributed evenly across this country. So those who have more money have more voice. And that's why I think regardless of the, you know, the Buckley decision is law, but I disagree with it because to me it violates the one person, one vote concept.
Professor, could you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on conflict of interest as it may relate to the legislature?
Well, conflict of interest is the idea that in a democracy, our public officials, both legislative and in the executive branch, are supposed to make decisions in the public interest and not in their own personal interest. If there may be a decision that you're going to make that could benefit you, you should excuse yourself from that decision-making process because you have a conflict. It might benefit you. We have an Executive Branch Ethics Act in Alaska, as we do in the United States, with very strict rules on what you can and cannot do. However, with the legislative branch, because we have in our constitutional government a division of powers between executive and legislative, the Executive Branch Ethics Act does not apply to the legislature. The legislature has to police themselves. And one of the things that has been very disappointing is the legislature has not policed themselves in Alaska. They have not held themselves to the standard of conflict of interest, nowhere close to the way the executive branch is held. They've certainly had personal employment, family employment, business ownership, many things that on the executive branch side would have been immediately ruled a conflict of interest. What they're missing is the concept which is called perception of impropriety. It looks bad. It looks bad. It's suspicious. It could be something where you could make a self-interested decision as opposed to a public interest decision. And what this legislature doesn't seem to get is the fact that when they make these decisions, no matter how noble they feel themselves and they know that they're not being influenced in any way whatsoever, it looks bad.
Okay, here in Alaska, we certainly have the perception that we're different. You know, we call the rest of the country the lower 48. And many of us take pride in our uniqueness as Alaskans, or at least our perceived uniqueness. What are some of the consequences of our separateness, if you will, from the lower 48?
I think Alaskans don't really understand how the rest of the country views these actions. When we have our state legislators indicted, convicted, when we have others indicted, Alaskan citizens don't seem to be that disturbed about it. We're uncomfortable. We sort of don't like it. But I hear more justifications of it than I hear great offense or disgust or realization that this is a challenge to our whole system of democracy. I read a letter to the editor in the Anchorage Daily News several months ago in response to some sort of accusations. And it said, you know, our representatives deserve their cut. Look what they did for us. And I was just appalled, but I thought this was really representative of the Alaskan attitude of as long as they bring in the dollars, we have no complaints. We should be out there looking at what they do and holding them to the standards we would like to say what America stands for. Ultimately, they're going to be a reflection of us. To the extent that our leaders are allowed to do things, that's a reflection on what we allow them to do. And it's a reflection on us and our ethics.
Dr. Jonathan Anderson is a professor at UAS. We chose to speak with him because of that professional background. But in the name of full transparency and to make sure we're ethically okay, we want to let you know that he's up for re-election this fall for his Juneau Assembly seat. Now, if a kid is a high school runner, movies and television shows would have you believe he or she hangs out only with other runners. In the hit movie Juno, the father of Juno's baby was repeatedly shown running along with his team, rarely with anyone else. But in reality, students' social lives aren't quite that rigid and defined. Students are trying to figure out who they are and who they relate to, in person and online. Rachel Kavapal has more.
It's early Wednesday, and 8th grade student Andrew Jensen is eating breakfast as he talks with two students who appear as polar opposites. One is dressed in jeans, tennis shoes, and a polo shirt. The other is in black eyeliner and lipstick that matches her black baggy pants and a snug striped shirt that shows off a metal-studded wristband. Despite their differences, Jensen says this social mix is typical for him.
A lot of the people are either like nerdy, geeky, punk-like, or goth. Also, there is this one girl. I call her a primo because she's a preppy emo.
Jensen is one of the early adopters of hybrid clique names like Gunk for Geek Punk or Nep for Nerd Prep. They are assigned to students who clique float, that is, they associate with more than one clique on a daily basis. Some students, like sophomore Sarah Getz, aren't familiar with or even buying into the hybrid name system. However, they do agree clique floating is common.
I know people who are like hanging out with the swimmers one day and the next day they'll be hanging out with the hockey players and then they'll be with like the goths.
It's easy to attribute clique floating to social networks like MySpace or Facebook or My Yearbook where diversity reigns free. Getz says she regularly socializes online with people she wouldn't hang out with at school, in part because she likes people, but also because she doesn't want to appear mean by ignoring someone she doesn't know. Jensen, on the other hand, is much more selective online, even if his peers don't share his selectivity.
Some people are like popularity leeches, where they'll make friends with whoever's the most popular at the time, so they become popular.
You see us as you want to see us, in the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain,
and an athlete,
and a basket case,
a princess,
and a criminal.
The first weekend after the start of school, goth nerd Ursula Katie and nerd prep Talia Jacobs are watching the ultimate 80s film, The Breakfast Club. Though Katie and Jacobs are both clique floaters, they find it hard to believe that five students so entrenched in their cliques would come to respect each other in just one afternoon.
Some of it's unrealistic, like everybody being good at heart. That usually doesn't happen, and the jocks are usually jerks, not earnest, open people. And I think that the media definitely just has its little fairy tale side, which skews everything.
If people have an idea, like, of what to look for in a person to decide what they are, they're like, oh, hang on, that I recognize that. I saw that on TV. That makes you a nerd, or that makes you a jock, or whatever.
Jacobs is against cliques because they encourage students to behave according to an established set of rules. Katie sees cliques as a necessary evil.
People are so different, and they need a way to, like, express their difference. So they form a group of people exactly like them, so they can all be different. Say one person decides that wearing this type of clothes is really cool, then maybe five more people will also decide that that looks really cool, and even if they aren't exactly like that person in the way they think, they may start to dress like them and act like them.
Both girls agree that most people outgrow cliques, while some hang on to them for the rest of their lives. Others, like Andrew Jensen, aren't waiting until adulthood to form a diverse social circle. Jensen says he will always jump from group to group, making friends who are different from one another. For AK Radio, I'm Rachel Kavapal.
And that's AK for this week. We had help from KSKA's Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rachel Kavapal in Fairbanks, and APRN's Libby Casey in Washington, and Andy Fite in Anchorage. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the rundown for the show on the archives page. While you're there, sign up for our podcast. Check out our past shows, or send us an email to let us know how we're doing. AK's Ellen Lockyer reported from Palmer this week. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. Jessica Cochran is our senior producer. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Scott Burton. Join us again next week for the second part of our series on the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood.
AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, whose mission is to provide programs and services which inform, enlighten, and enrich the public. The Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com. And by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.